Hey guys, welcome to a really, really special episode of our podcast. I'm here with Mr. Kevin Carter, the founder, chief investment officer, and the Index Committee lead for EMQQ, one of the first emerging market funds on NYSE. So thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate, you know, all the time and effort that you've put into joining us today. And, you know, we in India, we live in a bit of a bubble. We think a lot about everything that's going on over here, and we're very positive about our future. But you've also been a big proponent of the India story. And I wanted to hear your perspective as an outside perspective. Why does India hold so much attraction to you as an investor?
Sure. Well, first, let me say namaste, India. And it's great to be here and be on your show. So I've been focused on emerging markets for about 20 years now. And, for the first part of that, China was really the driver of growth in emerging markets. But now, in many ways, China's emerged, at least when it comes to the internet and the e-commerce, as we're focused on. And now it's India's turn. So, as you know, China was the last 10 years of this incredible digital story. And now India really stands out as the biggest part going forward. And, you know, again, as someone that's been focused on emerging markets for 20 years, I think that it's fair to say that India is perfect in terms of, you know, what you're looking for in emerging markets. And you know, the reason that investors are interested in the emerging markets are the four things. Emerging markets have a lot of people. India has the most. And if you leave out China, India is bigger than every other emerging market together. So the scale of India is unmatched. The demographics are also unmatched. They're so favorable. You know, China's now has a demographic profile that looks like a developed country. So India is the biggest population. It's the youngest population, has the fastest growing economy, and that's driving and should continue to drive a massive amount of consumption. So on paper, India is perfect. And so I share the optimism that India has in its future. And but just having everything on paper, just the basics, that's not everything you need to have, you know, growth and prosperity. And it's really the other things that India has on top of that that I think make it just incredibly special and the perfect emerging market for investors.
So I'd love to expand on these other things that you mentioned, right? Because, you know, one thing that we often that we know in India is that population can be a boon, it can be a curse, yep. Right? You get a lot of people and a lot of young people in particular. If they have money, they have jobs, they're consuming, great, all well and good. But things can go very bad if, you know, things don't continue to grow, if people remain unemployed, if, you know, people don't move up the value chain.
Sure.
So what's this other stuff that you feel that is adding a lot of value in supporting Indian growth stories?
Sure. Well, first, let me say, you're absolutely right. I mean, you need jobs and you need, you have a lot of youth. Unemployment, and it's not India low. China has similar issues right now, but the things that India has, first of all, the leadership, you know, of the last 10 years, you know, Modi has really done a great job of cutting out a lot of the red tape and things that make it hard to do business. But he's also doubled the country's infrastructure. So you know, when I got involved with emerging markets 20 years ago, China and India were basically the same size in terms of the economy. But China was able to build the world's greatest infrastructure. And with a one-party system, you know, that was pretty easy, relatively easy. And India, you know, as you know, the power didn't even work consistently for a long time. But Modi has essentially doubled the infrastructure that, as we were talking about before the cameras came on. I mean, you don't have to look very far to see it. It's outside of every window. And so that physical foundation is finally getting laid. It's not close to over, and there's a $1.5 trillion master plan, but it's finally getting in gear. So that's an important part of the story. But I think what really sets India apart is, first of all, the human capital. I mean, you have a technology sector that's older than I am. Yeah, Tata was originally Tata Computer Systems in 1968, so a year before I was started. So you have this ecosystem and publicly traded tech companies, Infosys, TCS, et cetera, self-made billionaire founders. And so this ecosystem that's very vibrant and has employed, you know, millions of Indian, managerial and tech talent. You have incredible technology and management. You know, the IITs and the IIMs produce world-class talent. And, you know, as an American, you can see this. We have 25 S&P 500 companies that have Indian CEOs, including Google and Microsoft. So you're not going to find this in Vietnam or in Mexico or the Philippines. So this is really something that sets India above everyone else, I think, in emerging markets. And what's also important is that it seems clear there's been a shift, and this is, I think, quite recently, but a shift towards entrepreneurism and to entrepreneurship here in India. There's a lot of talent that's gone to work in Silicon Valley and you know, places like that. But now I think it's very clear that entrepreneurism has been unleashed here. I mean, that, you know, 7 years ago there was less than 500 startups. Today there's 120,000.
Yeah.
So that human talent is unmatched. And again, this is hard to quantify, but you know, I think it's that human talent is increasingly interested in devoting their efforts to India and not necessarily Silicon Valley. And then the final thing that sets India apart from other emerging markets and from developed countries as well is the digital public infrastructure, the India Stack. And this, to me, is an absolute game changer. And it has already proven its power. It's proven its value. And it has really allowed India, in many ways, to leapfrog a lot of the, you know, gradual development that we've seen historically. India has been able to do things in 5, 6, 7 years that would have taken, you know, 60 years without the stack. So the stack really is, I think, India's secret weapon. And you know, there's no developed country that has the digital public infrastructure that India has. And as someone that talks to a lot of investors globally, the global investor population, they have no idea about this incredible genius of it, basically an operating system for the whole country that is the India Stack.
Yeah. No, I'm really glad you brought up the India Stack. I mean, personally, I'm a huge, huge believer in what the India Stack will do for this country over the next 15, 20 years. But from your perspective, I'd love to understand, how do you see the India Stack as it grows, as its implementation deepens? How do you see it changing, I guess, the way growth happens in India? What do you see the real impacts of the India Stack be?
Well, I mean, you've already seen it. You used it, you know, to bring 800 million people into the banking system, you know, opening bank accounts in a matter of minutes, what used to take a week. You've seen private enterprises like Jio leverage the stack and take, you know, a 3-hour business process of, you know, signing up a new subscriber, chop that down to 10 minutes. So the efficiency, the speed that it provides, you know, it's already proven itself. And as discussed, you know, before, that whether it's the fast tag, the account aggregator, there's so many parts of the stack. And, you know, as Nandan Nilekani says, you know, the country has made multiple nonlinear changes in how things are done. And the combinational power of those is huge. And I think it really, it deserves a lot of credit for where India is today. I think it's going to continue to be just incredibly valuable. And you see the entrepreneurs that have built businesses that couldn't have happened without the stack. So it's created an immense number of entrepreneurial opportunities, which are the kind of things you need to create jobs as well. So that's another reason why I think that this entrepreneurship that's exploding here is very important, because entrepreneurs ultimately are the people that create jobs more than anything else.
That's 100% true. So one of the central themes, so just for some context for our viewers, the EMQP fund invests in emerging market digital commerce companies, but the INQP fund invests in digital companies based in India. The core thesis around that, broadly speaking, correct me if I'm wrong, is the rise of a digital consumer in India. So I'd love if you could sort of expand on that thesis and that perspective a little bit more, because you've obviously seen it play out over 20 years.
Sure. Well, the foundation of my business and all of our strategies, they're all investing in the same story. And it is basically, there's three mega trends, three large one direction trends that are sweeping the planet. And the, you know, but in the United States, we don't think of these as trends because we've been part of them for generations. But these three mega trends are, first, consumption. And when I was a kid, we had plenty of food. We took vacations. My brothers and I were the first to go to college, but we've been in consumption mode for a while. Well, the emerging market consumer, the China consumer, the Brazil consumer, the India consumer, they're now making more money, a little bit at a time, and they want all of the things that we have in the developed world. More and better food, more and better clothing, air conditioners, heaters, and appliances. They want to be entertained, to go to a movie, take a vacation, get on an airplane for the first time. They want vehicles, and they want their kids to go to college. And that's ultimately what I've been focused on for 20 years. But 10 years ago, I realized that there was two other mega trends that were now part of the story. The first one, the computer. Now, I had a computer for 20 years before I got a smartphone. So I've had a very gradual experience with the computer. But most of those emerging market consumers, those Indian consumers, they're getting their first computer today, basically. And it's not a desktop computer. It's an Android-based smartphone that's getting better and more affordable every year. And then the third part of that is the internet. I got the internet in 1995 on a telephone line in San Francisco. It's obviously gotten better and easier to access. Now I can get it on airplanes. Well, most of the emerging markets were never wired. And so when those billions of consumers get that first ever pocket-sized supercomputer, they're also getting online for the first time. And because they haven't had bank accounts, they probably don't have automobiles, and there's no Walmart stores. The leapfrogging is happening, and it's driving a massive amount of consumption. So that was the thesis for the foundation of our business and EMQQ, which invests in all emerging markets. And 2.5 years ago, we launched the India focus. So it's, India's in all of our funds, but India is such a special situation that we created just INQQ, just to capture the Indian internet, or new age tech companies, as they're referred to here. So Zomato, Nika, companies like that.
So I'd love to maybe talk about INQQ, the fund you mentioned, for a little bit. But could you expand on the index methodology? How has it been constructed? Why these companies are in this fund? Why you selected them?
Sure. So our goal is to capture, you know, basically every publicly traded new age tech company here in India with INQQ. So as long as you're an e-commerce internet company focused here in India, and you meet our minimums for market cap and liquidity, we're going to include any of those companies. Right now, there's 25. 4 years ago, there was only two Indian internet companies that you could invest in, Make My Trip and InfoEdge. But during 2020 and 2021, there was about 25 Indian internet IPOs. So finally, we were able to create INQQ as an India-focused strategy. And so the goal is to identify those e-commerce and new age tech companies. And the IPOs did take a break for a couple of years, but as you know, they're back.
Yeah.
And so when we do our next rebalance, we rebalance and reconstitute INQQ twice a year, once in June and in December. So any of the companies that have gone public since June, several of which are internet companies, we'll add those in December. And then it uses a traditional market cap weighting system, but we have an 8% limit on the largest position. So again, it's companies like Zomato, Nika, InfoEdge, Policy Bazaar, and lots more coming down the pike, including the biggest ones, Jio and Flipkart, which hopefully one of them will at least IPO in the next year or so.
Yeah. I think this December rebalance is going to be really interesting, because there's so many companies that have and will come up, Swiggy, dozens and dozens of companies. So super interesting time. But I want to ask you a specific question. So for the Indian investors,
yes,
whenever we look at this segment, right, the main takeaway for most Indian investors when we look at, you know, companies like this,
yeah,
is valuation.
Okay, sure.
And I know that, you know, from having spoken a little bit of Kamar, you're a Roma guy. You like value investing. Yep. So I want to get your thoughts, because for price earnings multiple, which is a poor measure of valuation, but it's there, we'll use it.
It's a good starting point.
Yeah. They're very expensive. So do you see it the same way? Do you see it differently? I want to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, to me, the PE doesn't mean anything without the growth rate underneath it. So the PE divided by the growth rate, the PEG ratio, is to me the only multiple that matters. I mean, a 50 PE sounds high, but if your earnings growth is 50% or 70%, then it's not so high. So it's our calculation right now that the PEG ratio for the INQQ companies is a little bit over 1, which is actually less than the Nifty 50 PEG ratio, which is about 1.3. So, and let me also point out, you know, I was a very young, cocky value investor. And in 1998, I was shorting Amazon.com and suggesting other people do it as well. And, you know, the company didn't make a profit for 20 years, but it wasn't trying to do that. And so I see this. I mean, it's a very common, and, you know, when new growth companies with Tesla or Netflix or Facebook, they're always expensive at some point. But the miracle of compounding is so powerful that even if you bought Amazon at its top in the year 2000, and it had a 92% decline at some point, you've still made thousands of percent on your investment, even if you top ticked it in that, you know, 2 or 3 year window. So I'm not worried about the valuations for long-term investors. I don't make any short-term predictions about any stock market. I have no idea if these stocks are going to go up today, next week, this year. What I do know is earnings is what makes companies valuable. And the way you grow your value is by growing the earnings. And there's no group of companies in the world that I know of that have the opportunity to grow their revenue and their profits as quickly and for as long as these companies can. Because in almost every vertical, whether it's, you know, per capita spending on beauty products for Nike, or the, you know, percentage of people that fly on an airplane, they're so low that in almost every one of these verticals, they can experience 500% growth and they will still have 20 years of growth. Yeah. So it's so early. And, you know, one of my side missions is to help the Indian investor learn how to be a long-term investor. It's easy to get caught up in short-term swings. There's, I think, a lot of speculation going on in the options market. You want to buy and hold and buy and hold and keep doing that and let the miracle of compounding have a chance to work for you. And that's how you really make a lot of money in the investing in the stock market.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because here at Paisa Smart, that's the exact philosophy we preach. We don't talk about, you know, short-term trends. We don't talk about options. And we really, really want our viewers to be buy and hold kind of investors. And thankfully, that's the kind of audience we've got. So just to turn our attention towards this long-term view of, you know, the country and our growth trajectory and the growth trajectory of these companies in particular, over the next 10, 12 years, you know, broad economic projections suggest that it'll grow about 6 to 8%. And we've talked about the comparison with China before. And the real miracle about the Chinese economy was that it grew well over 10%, 10, 12, 13, 14%, you know, some years. India's not, there's a difference between 7% and 12, 13, 14%. Yeah. So I just want to hear your thoughts on that, whether you believe these projections, and B, whether that lower growth rate means that the projections for growth on these internet companies may not be as rosy, or maybe it doesn't matter.
Well, first of all, I think that these companies are going to grow, even if the economy didn't grow at all. I mean, this is a secular change in the way people do things. So even if the Indian economy grew 0%, you're almost certainly going to have growth in e-commerce in almost every category. Now, having said that, I'm not predicting 0% growth for India. I know that for most of the last 2 years, the estimates were 6.5%, but then they finally have gone up to 7%. And that seems to me like it's very manageable. And I frankly wouldn't be surprised if it grew even faster, perhaps in good part because of the India stack, as discussed. But China had, a one-party system, and it was really easier for them to muster up and execute against infrastructure development. And India is a democracy, and you know that that has a lot of benefits, but it may also mean that India can't grow as fast as China did. I think that 7% is definitely sustainable for some period of time. 8% may also be sustainable. I don't know that it can grow at 11 or 12%, but it certainly can stay at 7%, I think, for an extended period of time.
Okay. All right. So another question I had around this index is that you focus very heavily on consumption and digital consumption in particular. But another trend that we're seeing in India from the ground up is the rise of digital productivity. Right? And this is not really a new story for India, where IT services companies have been, you know, great value creators. I mean, they've given us people like Mr. Nirkani. But now another trend we're seeing is that because you have aging populations in developed markets, a lot of, and particularly after the pandemic, you know, with the digitization of work, a lot of digital productivity is driving value in India. Why, I guess my question is, why focus exclusively on the consumption side of things when there's maybe another element to the digital story of India, which is digital productivity?
Sure.
What's the logic?
To be frank, we have a little leeway in what we own and how we define it. Without getting too granular about this, you know, every company gets put into a database and they get put into boxes. What are you? What country are you in? What sector are you in? What subsector? What sub-industry? And none of those are internet. There's no box in the database that says new age tech companies. And so we own Freshworks, for example. So it's not all consumer facing, but the majority is. And the index will continue to evolve as we get more and more IPOs. And so we definitely have we use some judgment in declaring is this an internet and e-commerce company or not. But the main reason we're focused on the consumer in it is because the consumer is the story ultimately. McKinsey calls the rise of the emerging market consumer the biggest growth opportunity ever. And if they're right, then this is the best chapter, this India chapter that we're in right now.
Okay. So you alluded to this at several points. So, you know, you talk about this as an index, and we've sort of spoken around this subject a little bit. But another really big conversation that India is having in the investing space, active versus passive. And I mean, it's not unique to India. This has happened in the US.
Yep.
And I'm sure you have a very specific perspective on this. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this active versus passive debate and, you know, whether ETFs and index funds the right way to go, or, you know, whether there's still alpha for active money left.
Okay. Well, I love this question, and I have spent my whole career kind of on that. Kind of on both sides of this debate. As you referenced, I'm a Omaha Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger person first and foremost. But it was actually the 1995 Berkshire Hathaway annual report when I was reading it as a young man in my apartment in San Francisco, and I saw that Warren Buffett suggested that most investors should buy index funds, including institutions. And I thought, well, this is, how can he say this? This is my, you know, a hero, and I'm trying to emulate him. And he's saying that everyone should just buy the index. And obviously, that stopped me in my tracks. And I told my friend they could go out without me that night. And I stayed home to try to figure out what was going on. And what I realized was that he was 100% correct, because the reality is that if a stock market goes up 10%, and the active managers charge you 1.5%, then you're going to get 8.5%. Now, some of the managers will do better and some will do worse, but they're all going to charge you. And so by definition, the active managers have to underperform the index. It's not even debatable. Not all of them, but as a group, it's just basic mathematics. And now I see this in United States all the time. There'll be an active mutual fund CEO, and he'll say, oh no, now's the time. Stock picking is going to, you know, really shine, and it's going to be, that's not mathematically possible for the average active mutual fund to beat the index because of the fee, assuming the index fund is low cost or no cost as they typically are. So now, having said that, in emerging markets, it's the index that is the problem, because you have in emerging markets a lot of state-owned enterprises. The S&P 500 doesn't have these things, right? In China, the index, when I got involved, was 80% state-owned enterprises, and they're not trying to grow their value the way Apple is or the way Tata is. These are government-owned, you have a lot of corruption. So it's indexing works, but the emerging market indexes are not very good. And so I think what you want to do, if you're going to index, you want to get more targeted. And I made INQQ and our other strategies because I think they're the best place to target. It's where the best growth is. It's entrepreneurial. Almost every one of the companies, the founder is still the CEO. And so I think that investors should index. I should also say the Nifty 50, the Sensex, the MSCI India, these aren't as bad as most of the other emerging market indexes, mainly because the SOEs or PSUs, they're only about 10% of the index. So now, having said that, I'm an Omaha person, as mentioned. And so I think investors, I don't know that I would pay an active manager, but I think investors can do well by buying individual stocks for themselves and holding them, as Warren Buffett says, it doesn't matter how big your circle of competence is. It's how well you define the edges. And almost everybody's an expert in something. You know, when you go to the store, what you buy, right? So I think that investors can certainly beat the market by leveraging the things that they're experts in, and importantly, buying and holding, and letting the time, be your work for you. So I'm kind of on both sides of the active and passive side. And actually, just to expand on it, if you think about the investment, a continuum, you've got Warren Buffett and stock picking on this side. And on this side, you've got, Vanguard indexing, keep your costs low. But the reality is that it's more like this, where Warren Buffett's here and indexing is here. And again, the fact that Warren Buffett has both told everybody they should index and pledged that all of his money will be indexed when he's gone, these are the two right ways. Everything else
is all...
I don't have a positive... How do I say this without being offensive? It's all a bunch of baloney. Like a lot of the stuff that goes from the Warren Buffett, around, I think a lot of it's just a lot of talk but I'm kind of radicalized in my thinking about this.
I know. Okay, you've been in San Francisco for a long time. Another we've got indexing, you've got Warren Buffett, but certainly another point on this continuum is the Sequoias of the world, right?
Sure.
Which is an extremely profitable form of investing. Where do you put this? I mean, how do you view that investing style, private markets and venture capital and the like?
Well, obviously, fortunes are made in venture capital, and that's not just in the United States, that's happening here. It's hard to access, though. I mean, the reality is the Sequoias of the world, these aren't funds that can be easily invested in. But there's no doubt. I mean, I know a lot of the venture investors that have funded the companies that we're involved with, the guys that have written the first checks for Coupang in Korea or Zepto here or Lenskart, for example. So there's no doubt if you are an enterprising investor and you have the capital and you can find these entrepreneurs at the beginning and fund them, that they'll take your money, then yes, you can do extremely well, but it's hard to source those. It's very hard to source, and certainly here, it's going to become increasingly competitive. One of the things we did in Bangalore last week was to go see kind of a Shark Tank style pitch competition where 10 entrepreneurs came in and they each had 3 minutes to pitch their ideas to this venture fund we're friends with. And so No doubt, one of those 10 is probably going to do really well, maybe spectacularly well, but it's getting access and picking the right one. So I'm not against it. It's just not easy to access.
Makes sense. So my final question, is I think we find ourselves in a really interesting moment in economic cycles and in history, where you've got a rising India, but also the U.S. is in a really interesting position. We've just had President Trump return for a second term. I think the Fed's just coming off a historic, rate cutting cycle. Just wanted to get your perspective on the direction for the U.S. economy going forward, because there's a lot going on maybe in politics as well as in the economy. How do you see this next 4 or 5 years playing out for the U.S.?
Well, let me first say that, we've had a very intense year in the United States with the election. And of course, the Democratic candidate kind of changed in the middle of this. And I think that on both sides, emotions were high and confidence was high. And, half the country is sad and angry, and the other half, 51% is ecstatic. And so the polarization is, it's very real. And I don't think it's good. I don't have a solution for it, but clearly the election left a lot of people, unhappy. But I think that, we saw where a lot of the business people aligned themselves. Elon Musk is someone I think super important to the world and the United States. And, I think in some ways his endorsement of Trump and interest in being involved, that certainly I think helped Trump, at the polls, because I think a lot of other people, recognize Musk as being someone who's obviously done great things and bold,
yeah,
very bold things for the world. So I think that that Trump and his a lot of his policies and business friendliness, it will be good. Having said that, the idea of the tariffs that we're talking about, this is, I think, not good. And I remember one class from all my economics courses better than the other ones, and it was a course that dealt with tariffs and rent control, which are basically the same mathematics. And they're a tax. I mean, ultimately. And so it sounds great to say, oh, we're going to put a 20% tariff or a 50% tariff on things, but that results in prices going up. And so we just got done with this inflation thing, or it seems like we've turned the corner with inflation. And if we follow through with some of these tariff threats, I think that could actually be very bad. Now, the question becomes, okay, well, yes, he said he's going to do these things. The question is, does he in fact end up doing them, or is he saying them to help, the U.S. position at the bargaining table? Mm-hmm. So it's to be determined, but I think there's also, there's extraneous things that show up in the world. It doesn't matter who the president is. Other things can show up that can challenge countries and their economies and their growth. But, right now, things in the U.S. seem good. Interest rates are coming down, and that should help. That the housing market's been a little slow in the last few years, and real estate. So hopefully the lower rates will help get that back on track. So I'm optimistic, but you never know what's gonna come out of left field, as we say, and change the shake up the board.
Yeah,
we've got a lot of tensions in the world, and the Russia-Ukraine situation, and the Middle East story. But I like to use Modi's line about being an optimist. Pessimism has a short shelf life, and optimism is eternal. So I'm an optimist. So my outlook is tinted by that general optimism about the world.
Well, I think. So it's more fun to be an optimist than a pessimist.
That's true too.
And perhaps on that very optimistic note, on the optimistic note of India, perhaps we'll close this podcast and then thank our viewers for the time and Energy Dave stunned watching everything that you have to say. And Kevin, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. It's been a pleasure to have you on, and really, really appreciated everything you've said. Really learned a lot, and I'm sure our viewers have learned a lot as well. And thank you so much for coming in.
Great. Well, thank you. And it's great to be here, and I'll hope to be back again.
This podcast is produced by Elixir Equities Private Limited, a SEBI registered research analyst. Registration number INA00004787. The information provided in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only and should not be considered as investment advice. Investment in securities market are subject to market risk. We strongly advise all investors to read all related documents carefully before investing.